Welcome to the PMPA's Speaking of Precision podcast, featuring your hosts, Carly Kistler-Miller, David Wynn, and Miles Free.
Hello, I'm Miles Free, and welcome to PMPA's Speaking of Precision podcast. Carly Kistler-Miller and David Wynn have joined me today, and we are going to discuss why your expert is not your best trainer. Welcome, Carly. Welcome, David.
Thank you, Miles.
Thank you, Miles. I want to know what happens. I'm being trained by the expert.
I was going to say, both of my experts are on this podcast, and they're great trainers. So this is, I'm really curious as to what you have to say.
The expert and the novice live in two different worlds. And the expert intuitively understands every stimulus, everything, and holistically just masters the task. The novice doesn't even have words for what they're trying to do.
Okay.
How can they possibly communicate? How can they possibly succeed?
Okay.
So I think we need to take a better look at what the novice is trying to do, what they need to do, and then what might be a better way to get them what they need, rather than just fire hose them from the all-knowing expert who has no sympathy at all, no understanding that this person doesn't even have a name for that tool.
Yeah, because the expert was probably a novice how many years ago?
Yeah, I mean, they that memory's gone.
They don't remember how they learned. They just, it's part of their
everyday
thinking.
And they don't think about the stimulus. They just, it happened, da-da-da. They just do, right? Yoda, do.
You need an intermediary, someone to translate.
Absolutely. So to me, the novice's work isn't to understand the job. It's to learn how to learn about the job. They need to learn the rules. They need to learn the safety. They need to learn what not to do. There is so
the
much.
The terminology.
The terminology, yeah. Right? I mean, right? So an expert, we talk about highest and best use. This is a micrometer. Come on. Right? The expert.
That's not what you want your expert doing.
No, I don't think so.
I can understand that. All right, so the novice is a blank slate, essentially.
Essentially,
I mean, they come in with some training, but we all know that the textbook and real life don't always match up. So then the expert has all this knowledge, and somehow we need to transfer it, or maybe the expert just shouldn't be the trainer.
Well, I don't think the expert should be the trainer at this stage. So
okay,
the novice is trying to learn the basics, the vocabulary, what to do in the tasks, the names of things, and just to prove I can't count, they need to stay safe. So there's four things.
Okay.
Okay? They're juggling four things. They how are they going to do that? So they need time on task. They need repetition. They can get some familiarity. The expert is going to be bored to tears if they're spending time on task doing the repetitive things that they learned decades ago.
Kind of like an English lit professor teaching ABCs to kindergartners.
There you go.
Okay. You know? All right. Yeah, I would not want my professor doing that.
So having been in the expert seat once or twice, we get into autopilot. It's just, you know, here's a question, and boom, here's the answer. It just springs out of our brain, right? How did you know that was a, well, I just knew.
Well, forth from the fountain of knowledge.
How does that translate?
What's that, David?
I said forth from the fountain of knowledge. It just springs forth.
Yeah.
When he said that, I just picture Miles like, the knowledge pouring out.
The knowledge pouring out.
Yeah, and so we've all been beginners too, right? We've all been novices. And how many times have we been trying our best and had the person that's showing us what to do just say, just do it like I do.
Get frustrated.
Just do it like I say.
So many times.
Do as I say.
Do as I say.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
It's kind of like your theory. You're saying that you don't need somebody who's 10 steps above. You need somebody that's one or two steps above. Someone that's closer to the reality of the novice. So you need an intermediate to teach the novice who is maybe 6 months or a year ahead of the novice because they can communicate.
That's exactly right, David. That is exactly what we need. We need the person that just learned it to train the person that's just learning it. They're familiar with the dysphoria of not knowing why it happens. They're familiar with I don't know what that thing is or how to touch it or when to pick it up or even how to hold it, right? How to hold it. How many times have we seen the two-handed Mike welding clamp, you know, measurement technique, right? You're not going to get to tens with that, you know?
That's true. You know, it's kind of, I have an image in my head of the leadership ladder, and you want the guy that's the next step ahead holding that person's hand and pulling them up. You don't want the leader at the top dangling a rope down and trying to jerk somebody up 10 stairs.
10 stairs is about right.
I love that image. That's a great image.
It really is.
Yeah.
How many ropes are we pulling in our shops, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Plus the person who's the next rung up, for lack of a better word, they will probably be about the same age, and they would be speaking the same language with the same background, so the communication is a lot smoother.
Right, and it'll be fresh in their minds what that surprise, use two fingers and now I can hold it, right? Mm-hmm. Now I've got it. They're going to be so much more, I guess, close to the novice's, you
way
know,
of
state
thinking.
Of mind. Yeah,
yeah,
way of thinking.
They'll have that emotional connection because it wasn't that long ago they learned how to do it. And the expert may have learned to read a mic 30 years ago, and they don't even remember what it was like to learn it.
No. Yeah. And
they don't even know
what
to
do. So you lose that social emotional connection.
And by the way, they have no idea what this digital business is. They're looking at the vernier. And, you know, the novice is looking
at the digital readout. They don't even have a dial caliper.
Digital readout, right? So my point is the expert's a poor match to a novice. And we were talking at lunch about, you know, some performers in a volleyball game where we had, you know, some real ringers, you know, spiking the volleyball when the 9-year-old girls were on the other side. They didn't have a chance. You know, it's just a mismatch. And I think we do that when we use too high a level of trainer.
That makes sense.
And I think,
because then,
you know, a lot of times when you take someone that's the, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say the novice might be afraid to say that they don't understand too.
Right.
So they're like, okay. And they think in their head, well, I'll figure that out later. I'll look that up later.
And then the next day they just
and it's gone.
Go look at another job because they're frustrated and they have fear. Fear, right?
Fear. They back have to fear.
I'm not going to admit I can't do this.
Right.
You know,
Dave, what were you
and the
say?
Characteristics of a functional expert don't typically lead well to being a trainer. They're not typically teachers. They're functional experts, and they have certain personality characteristics that make them functional experts. But they're not a teacher necessarily. Some are.
I was going to say, there are exceptions to every rule, and some experts can break down the fundamentals to train a novice. But I think all in all, your theory's right.
Yeah, I think a lot of, as David uses the term, functional experts, it's wired in. I mean, they just do it, right? They just do it. They just pick up the phone. They've got, I know, back in the day when you didn't have the phone dial itself, they just knew the number, right? I had an expediter had 400 different phone numbers in his head.
Wow.
400 different, we needed riggers, he called riggers. We needed millwrights, he had cat track, he had everybody in his head.
Yeah. And there's people that just get it. I'm going to be a proud papa moment here, but like my son, you know, he's 9 years old, but he has this mechanical mind. He can just take things apart and figure out what's wrong with them, put them back together. He doesn't have to look at a blueprint. He's never even seen it before. His last weekend when he was on spring break, they've been having trouble with the pallet jack at the shop. I didn't even say anything. He went over there. It wasn't working. He took it apart, figured out what was wrong, and fixed it.
Wow.
He just, you know, randomly plays with it and gets the hydraulic working again.
That's amazing. But it,
that's hardwired.
It makes a good point that some stuff is innate, that you don't even know that you learned it, or maybe you didn't. It's just natural.
Right.
Just natural.
And it's hard to teach that when it is natural for you, right. And then it's unnatural, especially if you're trying to teach somebody that it's unnatural for. There's no connection whatsoever.
The one thing that I will say when we talk about a recent success, reaching back to train, you know, the new novice, is they kind of burn in that knowledge. They do by training others, they reinforce what they know. And they may get another moment of clarity as they try and explain it. And all of a sudden, ta-da. That makes sense for the two of them, and so the two are on a process of co-discovery and collaboration. So my argument is, don't train with the expert. Train with someone who's just recently figured it out. They'll share the frustration. They'll share the context problems. They'll share what worked, what didn't work. The recency of the lessons will help. And I think they've added to their skill set by training. At the same time, they've added to your shop's resiliency by training another performer.
This kind of falls in your, I've got Dave's ladder analogy in my head, and it also reminded me of the escalator.
Yes.
You were talking about,
man.
That. You can't have everybody getting on the escalator at once, and they all can't stay at the bottom either. You got to keep moving them up. So using then that ladder, every person's on a rung pulling the next person up.
Each one reach back and train one. I mean, it's sustainable. It adds resiliency, and, you know, I mean, we're going to hear about that matrix that Chelsea uses it to cruise manufacturing at the tech conference. I mean, if we can't create a trained organization, we're gonna die with an untrained organization.
You just described the ultimate organization that is elevating everyone, because the person at the top is pulling the next person down, next person down, next person down. And so everybody gets elevated. And so the person at the top moves up because they have the ability, because like we've talked about on another podcast, where they're delegating. So now that next person can take over what they were doing, and they're able to amp up and elevate their skills. And then it just keep bringing that along, and you can grow your organization like that.
You know, David, that reminds me of one of my favorite blogs back in the day. And I was talking about training, and somebody says, well, what if I train them and they leave? And I turned and said to them, what if you don't train them and they stay?
That's a good point.
What if you don't train them and they stay? I mean, who wants to wallow in stagnation? Why do we want to just be, you know, Groundhog Day on process knowledge?
Save as.
No, thank you.
So, okay. As we sit here in our cushy little podcast studio explaining the utopia of training, what does a leader do when they come across the person who's on the next rung who doesn't want to share because of that fear you're talking about? That, well, if I tell them, then they could take my job.
So if you have a culture where people really think that if they share something, they're disposable, I would suggest to you that they're going to leave anyhow. If your culture promotes that, then they're going to go. If they can't be made comfortable with sharing in your culture, then you need to help them find a culture where they will be comfortable, because they're clearly not going to be contributing, and they're going to be an eddy in the training efforts of all the people who come after them. And how many people has been just a PMPA since they hired me, right? Oh, I'm afraid to train anybody, right? I mean, there's always a change. So we have to take the fear away, and maybe we need to demonstrate. Look, here, these people trained these people, and they're still working. Oh, they got promoted. Oh, they have a better shift, better opportunity, better task list, whatever. So make the fear go away. I remember as a boss, I had a salesperson, an inside salesperson, and she came into work one day. She was crying. Her face was red. Her eyes were swollen. I thought she'd been beaten. I said, "Who did this to you?" And she says, I made a mistake. I made a mistake on the freight bills for a shipment of steel." And I said, "Okay. So why do you look like somebody's beat you?" "Well, I cried all night." "Well, why did you cry all night?" "Well, I was afraid you'd fire me if I didn't pay the mistake on the freight. And if I paid the mistake on the freight, then I couldn't make my trailer payment and I'd lose my trailer." So she felt that making a mistake on the job equaled either losing her job or losing her trailer and then losing her job. And I said, "Look, it's $200. It's okay. You can make a $200 mistake." She had no idea. Every decision that she made had to be perfect or it was sudden death.
Catastrophic.
Sudden death economics. Mm-hmm. I have to tell you, when we took that away from her, that fear, she became top performer in the office.
I'll bet. Well, because $200 to her, she can't afford a $200 mistake in her personal life.
No.
So it's hard to imagine that a business can sustain a $200. So if by you explaining that, yeah. I mean
we
that
probably
just
got
had to
that.
Be the weight of the world off of her.
Absolutely. I mean, we probably got $200 on recycled soda cans.
Right.
You know, from the shop vending machines. I mean, it's $200. Yes, $200 is a lot of money.
It is a lot of money. But in the big picture.
But proportionally to the steel order, it's not.
Right.
You know, you got a $50,000 truck of steel versus a $200 freight.
Well, that's right. I mean, the responsibility, this person was billing probably, I don't know, $100,000, $200,000, maybe $500,000 worth of freight a day. Right? How many truckloads? Okay. Yeah. What's the percentage of error on the dollar value of shipments in this one clerical mistake? It's trivial. But it was sudden death.
But you gave her that perspective, and
right.
That's what helped.
Yeah. Right. So
yeah, it emotionally was a lot to her. Mm-hmm. That was the biggest thing. Is it, from her perspective, this is killer.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So it does make a difference who trains and how they train. And I think that someone who's emotionally closer in time, closer in ability, makes a better host for the training experience than some authority from the sky that just smotes lightning bolts all around and do this, don't do that, and there it is.
Agreed.
That's my take.
I think it's a good take.
That wraps up today's podcast on Who is Your Best Trainer?
For additional information, please visit pmpa.org, where you can find our knowledge centers filled with articles, webinars, more podcasts, and other resources for precision machining.
Yes, and don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast so you won't miss one. Plus, check out our Speaking of Suppliers podcast, where we talk to PMPA technical members and learn how they can help our shops.
And if you aren't already taking advantage of a PMPA membership, be sure to check out PMPA.org and learn how we can help you thrive. And why is a PMPA membership important, Miles and Dave?
Because we are better together.
Don't forget to join us next Monday on Speaking of Precision.